This is episode 1-1 of the Software Freedom Law Show. Hi, and welcome back to another episode. We're here. We might sound a little bit different.
Well, we're in my office now.
We've moved locations.
Well, I always have to go to your office since the very beginning.
Since the very beginning, I like my office.
Well, it wasn't just that. So this is one of the horrible things, the many, many horrible things about living in New York City.
I think there are many wonderful things about living in New York City.
Mostly horrible things.
No, mostly wonderful things.
For me, mostly horrible things. And one of the horrible things is there's noise everywhere. It just doesn't stop. So in our offices, we have two different incompatible HVAC systems, and the one near...
Okay, you can't blame New York City for the HVAC systems, because any office that we would be in would have some sort of HVAC system. It's not New York City's fault that we have ones that can't be shut off noise-wise.
But New York City is the home of tyrannical building management.
I don't think that's unique to New York.
It's not unique,
but... Unique New York? Sorry.
It's not unique?
Sorry, I'm a little punchy today, I guess.
It's not unique, but it is, in fact, the worst here, I think, of anywhere. And we have these complicated HVAC systems, and the one by your office we were able to turn off completely in the winter, but in the summer, if we do that, everybody gets really hot really fast, so we can't do that. Mm-hmm. Now, the systems in my office, we can turn off, but they're not really off. They still have a background noise. Mm-hmm. So that's what we're dealing with now. So we'll see how this sounds. Our producer, Dan, will tell us if this is better or worse than last time. Last time he said, there's some new background noise. Of course, that was the first time we didn't turn off the HVAC system. And, of course, he heard it on the recording. So
we're sorry if it's harder to hear us. And thank you, producer Dan.
Yeah, well, he always says at the bottom of those messages that you sound so much better than most podcasts out there as far as audio quality. The thing about podcasting is the bar is so low for audio quality in a lot of ways, because I think a lot of podcasts don't have very good audio quality because it's hard to get.
Yeah, well, we owe our audio quality to producer Dan, who told us exactly what equipment to get and how to use it.
And he also does magic with various free software programs like Audacity and a few others that he uses to make it sound good.
Which allow us to talk about many issues, including current events.
I thought people wanted to hear more about our audio quality. It's the meta podcasting thing. It's big these days.
It's good for a few minutes, but...
Okay. You're probably correct. So we've had to somewhat preempt our plans a little bit because there's such this big thing happening. We're getting emails about it.
We got a request for a show.
We got multiple ones,
actually. We got multiple ones, it's true.
To ask us to cover this particular topic.
Yes.
So since we don't have a guest, do we have to tease the topic before we get into the topic? Are you going to make me do that as well?
We already did.
Oh, we did? Is that enough? Is that enough? Okay. I don't know how much we're supposed to do. But so there's been quite a hubbubaloo.
Hubbubaloo?
A brouhaha?
Kerfuffle?
A kerfuffle, yeah. Is that too? All this stuff. About this whole issue of C# and Mono, mm-hmm. and free software implementations of Microsoft technologies and programming language infrastructure and lots of arguments, mm-hmm. about all these, mm-hmm. issues and various projects everybody's debating, everybody's talking about it.
Yeah, so this actually came to light recently because of Richard Stallman's article. Is that how it's come up? That was the first I saw.
How do we ever know how a thing like this starts, really? Well, it goes back much longer.
Well, I was going to say, I'd like to know the history of it because I'm not familiar.
Yeah, it goes back longer than most people realize. And it was actually one of the first things I was involved with at the Free Software Foundation back in 2001. Mm-hmm. One of the first projects back then, Miguel and Nat.
Did dinosaurs roam the earth?
Probably. Miguel and Nat had just started Helix Code. Which was the name of the company before it was Zimian, which was the company that it was before it was bought by Novell. So this, mm-hmm. is going back a ways. And they had decided they wanted to start a project to implement this new thing that Microsoft was doing. And that goes back even further. So C# goes back even further to basically the late 1990s. So in the late 1990s, mm-hmm. Java was the hottest thing, mm-hmm, ever. Mm-hmm. Of course, my job is always hot because I still think it's primarily coffee, not some crappy programming language. But but
come on now.
I'm not a fan of Java. On technical grounds only. That's all I'm commenting on in that particular statement. But Microsoft was angry that Java existed at all and that Sun had control of it. Of course, Sun was very, very hardcore proprietary in those days. It was before we had things like OpenJDK. That's been a recent development. Mm-hmm. So this was a proprietary technology, and other proprietary software companies get angry at proprietary software companies. That's what they do with each other. Mm-hmm. And they didn't want to have Java be the dominant programming language on Microsoft systems. People actually believed Java was going to take over the world and nobody was going to write anything but Java. There are people in the industry who believe that. Well, I don't think that was likely to happen anyway, but...
Yeah, but a lot of people did believe that. I remember in the late 90s that being the case when dinosaurs roamed the air.
Right. So they started a project inside Microsoft called J++, which ended up in a legal skirmish with Microsoft, and it was difficult to get resolved. So they sort of killed the J++ product. It was going to be basically like Visual Basic, but Java and all this stuff. So they got into this big fight about it. There was trademark arguments and all sorts of arguments that were basically moot because Microsoft withdrew the product, stopped producing it. But they took all that technology and repurposed it into the CLR, the CLI, and C# language, which was it was basically almost a point-for-point imitation of Java in a lot of ways. The CLR is roughly the equivalent of JVM, and C# is very much like Java as far as programming feel. I mean, all this, people think, oh, the syntax is different, all that stuff, but as far as programming language philosophy goes, they're very similar technologies. They feel the same when you're writing in them, they have the same sort of structures, they're both static languages, unlike dynamic languages like Perl and Python. So they're pretty much similar technologies. But Miguel decided he wanted to launch a project to implement this stuff. What had happened was Microsoft found the one standards body that was friendly to proprietary software businesses.
Right.
These days, of course, we know ISO. What happened to ISO? Yeah, things have changed.
This wasn't the first time that
ECMA, is the ECMA, the standards body that C# went through, is well known for just doing whatever their donors and people who buy memberships with them.
Which is why there was already skepticism during OSML.
And they slammed it through ECMA. It went through very, very quickly and became this ECMA standard, which people say it's an ECMA standard, which means it means something. Well, it doesn't really. I mean, even after the OpenOffice ODF OXML issue with ISO, people still think ISO is a reasonable standards body, mostly. ECMA was never thought to be a really reasonable standards body by people in the software industry, at least. I think they do other types of standards unrelated to software, and that's, I don't know a thing about that area of their work. But in software, they're not seen as a major software-related standards body. So Microsoft gets this through. Suddenly it's a standard. Of course, free software people, our attitude has always been, and I'm in agreement with Miguel about this, if there's a technology out there that people are using, we should, of course, have a free software implementation. I don't think anybody, even in this argument that's going on right now, would dispute the idea that we should have an implementation of C#, CLR, CLI.
Right. That's and if free you read what RMS is saying in his article, he's not saying that either. He's agreeing with you, what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. And he and I think everybody, he, Miguel, I, Ubuntu, Fedora, everybody's in agreement about that. The software needs to exist. Now, there's also, I should mention, the reason I was involved in this in the early days was there was a GNU implementation of C#, CLR, CLI called Portable.net, which was actually started before Mono and was not tied to a specific company. It was one guy, initially it was one guy working in Australia. He had a few friends. They were all sort of independent contractors doing this work on their spare time, not affiliated with any large corporate entity. They all had their own little consulting businesses, but they weren't really associated with a single large corporate entity like Mono is. So there is this other implementation as well out there, which it's unfortunate people aren't talking about Portable.net in this discussion because it is another implementation, and
I mean, it's come up a bit in the discussion, mostly in comments, but still, people are talking about it.
Yeah, what are they saying generally?
Mixed. There's a lot of confusion.
I think that's true, and there's a lot of confusion going back to the start of both this project. It's actually almost an imitation of the KDE GNOME thing, because Portable.NET started 6 months before Mono did, and it was also the case that KDE started 6 months before GNOME.
Right.
And Miguel used to get into these arguments with the KDE people about, oh, well, KDE started 6 months ahead of time. Well, it turns out that Portable.NET was exactly the same scenario. It's kind of interesting that history repeated itself a little bit. But people aren't arguing specifically about the technology. Everybody's pretty much in agreement. The question is, how much should the free software community depend on that technology? I think that's where the center of this argument is.
Mm-hmm. And what technologies that one can choose, one should choose to use for different purposes?
Yeah, I think that is an important part of the argument, because people get worried that because a technology comes out of Microsoft, there's more risk involved with a technology from Microsoft than from another company, and or from the community. And I wrote a, we'll link to my blog post about this in the show notes that I wrote earlier this week, or I guess last week when you guys will be hearing this. And
June 29th.
My thought was, it's hard to, we record these things, I'll go meta again for a moment. We record these things early. Of course people must realize that.
Yeah.
But we have to be so careful with dates when you say things. It's very, very, very difficult, listeners, for your podcasters to know what dates to say they're in. They have to.
I know, and sometimes we wind up delaying because there's something current. We wind up delaying another podcast later, so we have to be careful.
Indeed, I feel confused all the time. It's like I have to pretend I'm in the future.
But
and
I don't think people care so long as we try to talk about things that are interesting.
Instead of going meta and talking about the fact that we don't know what date it is, is that what you're saying? Yeah.
Well,
okay.
You know.
So back on topic.
Back on topic.
Meanwhile, back at the point, as they used to say on Lug Radio. Back at the point.
Back at the point? Was that a reference to Back at the Ranch?
Yes.
Meanwhile.
I think it was.
Back at the Ranch. That was from, I think, from Dallas or whatever.
Back at the Ranch, but not Back at the
Ranch.
The point.
Well, Back at the Point was
a reference
to... Look, I had a TV. Well, actually, I don't know if it's actually a Dallas thing, but anyway.
I thought it was just a old Western thing.
It might be.
From, like, John Wayne style old Westerns.
Maybe it is.
I don't know. But anyway, meanwhile, back at the point.
I wish we had, like, a little musical, you know, doo-doo-doo-doo.
It's probably not Creative Commons licensed.
Wah, wah, wah.
The Linux Outlaws guys use that.
Oh my gosh, they totally do. I didn't even think about that.
Yeah. So we're not gonna go into our producer Dan's podcasting territory.
But we recommend you listen to their podcast.
Yes, it's very good. And Dan of Linux Outlaws is our producer. That's producer Dan, who's referred to. Anyway, back at the point. We were discussing this issue of programming language infrastructure. And what I had said in my blog post was that I actually think there are three categories of ways of looking at programming language infrastructure in the free software world. There's the community-developed stuff, things that we invented as a community, was free software from its birth, was implemented in the public space by contributors from many, many different commercial and non-commercial
sources.
Yeah. Those are languages like Perl, like Python, like PHP. Those are languages of our community. They were developed as free software from scratch, more or less. There's the PHP, there were some technologies around PHP that weren't free software at first, but generally speaking, even PHP was a publicly developed language, as Perl and Python were. And that's one class, I think, that has some special properties. Another class that has different properties is the class of software that's like C#, and you have to throw in this category as well, Java.
Yeah.
These are languages and language infrastructures.
And there are others, too. Yeah.
I think C# and Java are probably the two best examples. Mm-hmm. But the examples would encompass any language and its implementation, at least its canonical implementation and its infrastructure being developed primarily by one company.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a key point I'm going to get to in detail later, has been developed in less than 20 years ago.
Right.
And that's another class of languages. Then there's this third class, which are things that have been around so long, maybe they came out of a company originally, but they're older than 20 years and they're well implemented in standards bodies that we can generally trust.
standardized by standards bodies we can generally trust. And that's things like C and C++, which C goes back to the 70s, C++ goes back to the mid-80s.
Right.
They've been around for a very long time. Both
C++ is from the mid-80s?
Yeah, I actually researched this for my blog post because I didn't know whether to include C++ in the example list. I can never say this guy's name. Bjørn Strosup, the guy who invented C++, I apologize that I should, being in computing this long, I should be able to pronounce the inventor of C++'s name, but nevertheless, I can't. He published his first paper on C++ in 1988.
I didn't know that. That's really interesting.
I didn't know that.
Because it was 96 or 97 before I was introduced
right.
to it.
I didn't know that either until I checked. Yeah. I would have, if somebody had asked me before I did the research on this, I would have guessed 1992.
That's what I would have guessed too.
But it was actually like 1988 was his first paper on C++. So obviously,
but anyway, a long time ago.
Certainly more than 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so from each of these categories, we have to analyze what the situation is. And
should we analyze it after the break?
Oh, we have to take a break. That's true.
We don't have to take a break, but I like the break because I like our music.
Okay. So after the break, we'll talk about these three different categories and sort of analyze what how the free software world should react and have
what the implications are and why these situations are somewhat distinct.
Thank you for saving from that sentence that I was losing. So we have my three cases. And we're going to do a proof by cases.
A proof by cases?
This is what one of my professors in grad school used to say. Actually, his last name was Case.
Uh-huh.
And every proof, it was for theory of computation, every proof he did, he said, we'll do a proof by cases. We will list the cases that we have to show. And it was halfway through the semester before everybody laughed when he said this. And I asked one of my colleagues, like, why is he always talking about cases? Why is this his last name? I was like, oh, yeah, of course, his last name is Dr. Case. And people proof by cases. Of course, that's what you do. When you do a proof, you list out all the possible cases. And you guys do this in the law, too.
We do. I have a friend named... whose last name is Guest. Should we have him on as a guest?
Oh, because... do you have to do what your last name says? I don't know.
I don't make sandals.
Is that what Sandler means?
Yeah, it's a person who makes sandals.
Well, my last name is an adjective in German that means audacious. Am I professionally audacious?
You might be.
I don't think so.
Anyway, he does text adventure games and animation.
Oh, sorry, makes proprietary software.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's frustrated with the adventure software.
Besides, I hate games. You know me and games.
Yeah, I do, but I don't really play that many games, but I really love the text adventure games.
Yeah, when we had the Zoip on our
Zoip for it was Zork. It was so great.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I should explain to the listeners.
It was Zoip. Yeah.
Yeah, it was an implementation of Zork using voice over IP and speech recognition, and they called it Zoip. Zoip. West. Yeah.
West.
Well, you kept talking to it. But it didn't work. It couldn't really understand you that well.
It was so good.
Well,
you should just keep it on, put it on speakerphone. It was so much fun.
Yeah. It's mainly the speech recognition was not that good. The free software speech recognition stuff has issues still.
Yeah. But it was such a great concept, really.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with that. So. Meanwhile, back at the point, as we were saying.
Back at the point.
We're having that problem, this show.
The sticking to our point. Well, all right, we've got our three situations.
Right, and yes, the three situations. And of course, the reason I'm looking at it this way for a very specific reason, because I haven't, of course, said the P word yet.
Right, I thought you were kind of keeping it as a teaser.
It wasn't necessarily, but I actually had a motive. It wasn't teaser motive.
Okay.
Cause you know, I'm not down with the teasers.
I think you like talking about them more than anything else.
I love meta conversation. You know I do. So anything meta is good for me. be it teasers or anything else. But the actual real teasing, it was not what I was going for. What I was going for was to try to get across the idea that we shouldn't jump to what we're afraid of.
Oh, that's interesting.
Jump to saying, I'm afraid of patents, therefore
that's
I have
to... That's the P word, by the way. The P word was patents because what we're talking about here is coming from a fear of patents and their assertion.
Right. But I think that there's been a problem in the discourse because people jump to, I'm afraid of patents, therefore X. I think what you want to look at first is what is the reality and how does the legal system that's there affect it? How are these patents a threat? How is the copyright system a threat? How is the trademark system a threat?
I mean, the problem with patents is that it's so hard to understand and qualify what your risks are.
Right. And the most important thing when you're thinking about patents, and we've said this before on episodes that have focused a little bit more on patents, that it's probably the case when you start writing some software, like a case, that you will generate software that some patent in the U.S. patent system reads on. It's actually really hard these days to write software that doesn't infringe some patent that exists.
And it's really hard to search them to find out whether software does or does not. And there are so many patents that it would take a prohibitive amount of time to read them all.
And nor should you bother.
And if you did, you might be more liable for doing so.
Right. It's a very, very broken system. And we've talked extensively and lots of people in the free software community have talked for years about the fact that we have to end software patents. We have to make a world without software patents eventually, and then we have the problem of what do we do in the meantime? Well, when these things come up, don't approach it from a point of view, I must be paralyzed by these patents.
Right.
Because if we took that approach, we would just stop writing software. We'd say, well, patents cover software. It's virtually impossible to write some software that doesn't theoretically infringe some patent out there. So maybe I shouldn't write any software. And that
it's quite the opposite. The more software we write, the more protected we are for patents going forward.
Possibly. Right.
More than not.
it certainly doesn't hurt.
We're talking this way because there's an evidentiary problem where submitting code to the patent office is
often you're talking
inadequate.
About prior,
so
about
we're,
prior art
we're
question.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which
anyway,
is very, yeah. They won't. We wish we could mail code to the USPTO and say this code is prior art for this patent, but they won't take it that way, unfortunately. But that's a topic for another show.
That is certainly a topic for another show.
But on this issue of do patents cover a programming language and its infrastructure, I think we have to consider the possible ways programming languages came into existence, because there's only these few ways, really, that we get a programming language that people want to use. Now, in the first case, where we have things like Perl, Python, or PHP that are community-developed and community-implemented, there's a lot of really good side effects with regard to patents that happen in that case.
And by community, we don't mean that there weren't any companies involved at all. It's just not coming from one company.
Right. And the lack of one source, I think, is really important.
Yeah.
Because it means that there was no master plan with regards to patents, or with regard to patents.
Or not even a master plan. There's just... there's no one entity with that monopolistic power.
Right.
Over it.
There's two things going on. I think there's actually two points that are interrelated. The first is the one you said, which is there's no one entity that has total patent control over the language and its infrastructure. Simply because there was no way, it didn't come out of one company.
Mm-hmm.
So there was no way they could have applied for all the patents that covered it and been granted all those patents. Because many of those things wouldn't have been their work. It would have been work done by someone else that they brought in, which in that case, it's not patentable, at least from the point of view of the person picking it up off the internet.
Mm-hmm.
Because at that point, once it's on the internet, it's not, you can't file a new patent for it.
There's a grace period, but yeah.
You shouldn't be allowed to, anyway. So if there are patents, they're spread across many different entities. And the second thing is because that's the case, because you can't go and file patents on everything because you're developing in a community process with lots of other companies, plus nonprofits, plus individual developers working on their own time, you can't build what I was calling a master plan, whereby you file all the patents that cover and basically corner the whole technology in with your patents. You can't do it.
Right. And the reason why I guess I objected to simply referring to the master plan is that a company may not have a master plan starting out, but, you know, may evaluate its intentions today don't necessarily indicate its intentions tomorrow.
So are you talking about a company that contributes to one of these community ones or a company in another
category? I'm talking about your...
Second category.
Your second category.
I knew you were making a transition, which was great. To the other category, which is these companies that do sometimes either start with master plans, which I think is the case with Microsoft, or they eventually have a plan, a master plan to file for patents.
Yep.
And I think we can't let Sun off the hook here either.
Well, that's what I was about to say, is that it also goes both ways. I mean, what I was saying is that just because there's an intention today doesn't mean that, you know, even just because patents aren't being enforced today doesn't mean they're not going to be enforced tomorrow, but also quite the opposite, which is what you're talking about when you're referring to Sun, which is that if there are restrictions today there doesn't mean, it doesn't mean that a company won't change their mind tomorrow.
Yeah, and that's what I think is actually very dangerous, is that when you have a single corporate entity, mm-hmm. for profit, that holds the majority, or actually the overwhelming majority of patents on a particular technology, and particularly in this case, a programming language infrastructure and the language itself and its implementation, that's, I think, troublesome, especially if it's within the 20-year period, because patents last for 20 years in the United States, and you don't know what's going to happen to that company over time. That company may decide, after being totally fine with people implementing the yep. technology, they may decide to come along and enforce
or
the patents.
They may be acquired by someone who wants to enforce the patents.
Which is one of my fears about Sun, actually. You know, I don't see... Sun was really moving towards being more and more friendly to free software, but if this Oracle deal goes through, Oracle has never been a friend of free software. And I think that the fact they want to develop lots more proprietary database stuff and put it out there, who knows what they decide they want to do.
I think it's such
Java.
A big acquisition. I can't wait to see what happens.
But it's going to
really
be complicated.
Don't know how it's going to work out. Yeah.
The fact is, we don't know. We don't know what's going to happen with the patents that surely read on Java, that surely Sun holds. Microsoft is a little bit more frightening, I think, and that's why people are getting so upset about the C#.
I think Microsoft is a lot more frightening, personally.
Yeah, I think you're right, because they have a long-standing campaign of attacking
yep.
free software that goes back to 2001.
And they've even recently have been asserting patents.
Correct.
Yeah.
And in fact, as we saw with the TomTom case
yep.
and other cases where Microsoft's going around and enforcing their patents mm-hmm. against people who redistribute free software commercially. And that is the place where I understand people's fear.
Right.
I understand why everyone's so upset that C# is now going to be in default inside Debian, by default inside Ubuntu. And I think, though, that the reason this has come to be is because hackers made a choice. I think hackers chose to write important applications in C#, and
mm-hmm.
this is where I basically agree with RMS.
Yeah, well, I was going to say this is RMS's point, is that
yes.
we have a choice.
Right. And
yeah.
And there are so many programming languages out there that I think running to C# to write important applications in, I think is not the best choice. I think that I'm glad that people are re-implementing Tomboy as Gnote in
mm-hmm.
C++ now, and we're going to talk about C++ in a minute.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm glad that people are doing that, because I think that relying on that infrastructure, that this is where RMS really has a point, that of course nobody disputes that we need C#, and that we need to have an implementation of that technology as free software, because there will be programs written under it and we'll need it. Basically, people coming from the Microsoft world want to bring their programs over. They should be allowed to.
Right.
It should work for them. They
mm-hmm.
should be able to do it in freedom. But at the same time, writing new free software, important free software applications in those languages, is probably not the best choice. And I think projects should reconsider that, only because there's relatively more risk. It's not that there's not patent risk all over the map. It's just that there's relatively more risk because we know Microsoft is
right.
out to get
Although,
free software.
Although, you know, looking at the position statement that Ubuntu put out,
yeah.
I thought their analysis was very interesting and one that echoes a lot of our advice that we give.
Do you want to quote from it directly, or do you want to just summarize it? I'm fine with either way. I just wanted to see what you wanted to do.
You know, I think this parenthetical is probably actually the summary, which is while the Ubuntu project, which
you're quoting the Ubuntu statement.
Yeah, I'm quoting the statement. It's actually just a little parenthetical in there, but it says, while the Ubuntu project wishes to be responsive to patent infringement claims, we cannot commit to the assessment and review of claims made by anyone other than a registered rights holder. Which is to say that there are a lot of scary, you know, there's a lot of fear regarding patents, and unless someone is actually asserting them, it doesn't make a lot of sense to stop use of it or change dramatically what you're doing, because there's no actual legal threat, because there's no commenced threat or litigation.
Right. And we know of no case. There's no, I mean, it's we can guess it's happening behind the scenes, but we know of no public case where Microsoft has asserted these C-sharp patents against any commercial redistributor of free software, be it Mono or Portable.net. So Karen's right, and Ubuntu's right in their comments that we don't know, so we can't just jump to a conclusion.
Right. But I think what, you know, the point that RMS has, which I think is a good one, which is that when you talk about, you know, the relative likelihood of encumbrance, it behooves us to choose technologies that are less likely to be encumbered.
We know you have a choice in programming language infrastructures, and we hope you picked a community-developed, community-built, and community-designed programming language for your programming needs.
Or an old one.
So yes, just
transition to the third category.
So a lot of people in this debate have been saying, well, C and C++ were developed by AT&T, and therefore AT&T's big scary monopolist. I actually read a comment that said, you're afraid of the monopolist. What about the other monopolists who developed C and C++? Mm-hmm. Both of them were declared monopolies by the United States government and et cetera and so on. In fact, AT&T got declared a monopoly twice. The company's so nice, they made it a monopoly twice. Actually, it's not that nice. The company's so bad, they made it a monopoly twice.
Totally different company now, of course.
Right, and that's part of the point, is that it's been so long. It's been 20 years, more than 20 years,
since
the creation of C and C++. So two things are true. One, people did not get
more
as many.
More than 30 years, right?
Yeah, almost, at least for C.
Yeah.
Companies did not file as many software patents back then as they do now. So there's that in
itself.
Right,
well, there wasn't all the case law that we had since then.
Yeah, so the ability to patent software has grown incredibly over the last 30 years and gotten us to this horrible situation we're in today. And second, even if they had filed for patents on every last corner of C and how to implement C and how to compile C programs, those patents would have by now expired.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't have to live in fear of C and C++, because if there were patents out there, they're all gone.
Yeah.
They're all gone. So that's why that situation is different, and that's why those languages are a lot safer. In some ways,
they've been adopted widely because they're older.
Right.
Yeah.
In some ways, you could say those are the safest languages of all, because there are no patents left likely on them.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas even the community developed languages, there could be patents.
Yeah, I guess it just depends. I would hate to say that and find out that there were, you know, new versions of that there were features added to see that were patented later.
Indeed, that's correct.
This is me being a lawyer all over
again.
Right,
no, but you're right about that.
You can take no legal advice from this podcast.
one of the things that can often be true is you can patent a new technology for compiling those languages.
Right.
So a new way to turn them into object code, that could be out there. So,
right.
So again, this just goes back to the point of that there's patent risk everywhere. In software. It's just what we live with. So we can't jump to any conclusion about any specific thing. We can just make the best choices we have in front of us. And I think the best choice we have in front of us is avoid the technology solely developed by the company that's trying to kill free software. I think it's pretty good advice. And I know maybe we'll get some... If Miguel listens, I'm sure he'll send us an angry email. But I think that we have to reach
for new software.
I think the projects are very valuable to exist. I just think hackers should pick languages that are a little bit less dicey to do their work.
It's certainly something to think about.
I think so, too. And I hope that they will.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder if we have any more to say. I suppose we should say that a lot of people have claimed there is some assertion from Microsoft that licenses these patents. We are not aware of any assertion, and we did do a little bit of research on this. We haven't seen, at least in the public, there's not something out there. People reference things that don't seem to exist. But of course, there's no license from Sun explicitly for the Java patents necessarily either out there. I don't know of any. Do you? I guess their GPLv2 release is the best we can hope for with regard to that.
Yeah.
But there's no explicit statement about their patents, and, you know, AT&T's never made a statement about their patents. You know, every company out there, generally speaking, has not made, if they're not sort of a free software company, have never made a patent license promise. There are a few of those out there. Places like Red Hat have done them, but most large companies haven't done those. So we just don't know what the situation is, and posts that people have made on mailing lists about, oh yes, there's a patent promise that nobody can actually point to. You can't rely on that.
Right. I mean, I think we should probably close with what you closed with in your blog post, actually, and one that we constantly give advice about, which is, you know, don't let the fear of software patents paralyze your development. Like, it's, you know, make smart choices, but don't really worry about it unless you're direct. Well, as a lawyer, it's really tough to say it in unequivocal terms. But if you are threatened with a patent, with a patent assertion, then you should seek legal advice.
Right. So I think that what Karen's trying to say,
and stumbling over because I don't want to give unequivocal advice. Yeah. It's tough because you want to make smart choices and avoid situations that are going to attract liability where you can avoid it.
You're basically, as a developer, going to be in, as a free software developer, be in two situations. One is the one you should write to help at softwarefreedom.org about, which is you've received a letter from a patent holder or you've received a lawsuit from a patent holder saying you're infringing a patent. If those things happen to you, please write to help at softwarefreedom.org and ask for
legal help.
Or if
you have
your
own lawyer, that's great.
Right.
You know,
that's true. I'm just assuming these are free software developers who can't afford lawyers, which is what we're here for.
Well, you know, some people have...
some people are rich.
Some people are rich, and some people have connections.
True enough. And
there are other pro bono lawyers.
We are the connection for the free software.
We're happy to help.
If you aren't in either of those situations, and you're just waking up in the morning being afraid of software patents, you know, it's like H1N1, right? You should wash your hands all the time and be very careful about that, but don't spend your life in fear you're going to catch the swine flu. Just do your best to do the preventative measures that normal people taking care of
do. If you wake up with a bad cough and flu-like symptoms, though, see the doctor.
That's correct. We're not a medical podcast, and we cannot give medical advice about H1N1. But it's the same sort of scenario. There are things that create a lot of fear, and they create a lot of fear because there are legitimate concerns. But you can also take a legitimate concern so far that you paralyze yourself with fear. And I think a lot of people in the free software world live that way about software patents. I think you should pick languages that are either very old or very community-oriented and favor those and go about your business writing free software. And if you get a letter, seek legal help.
Leica, thanks for joining us.
I hope this has been helpful. I'm sure this conversation will rage on. But I think we've said what we want to say about it.
See you next time. The Software Freedom Law Show is produced by Dan Lynch of HalfBakedMedia.com. Thanks to Mike Tarantino for our theme music. This show is released under the terms of the Creative Commons Attribution No Derivative Works 3.0 United States license. Why did you keep talking about swine flu when this episode was about mono?
That's a little bit monoculturalist, you know.
Oh.
It's named after the Spanish word for monkey.